Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard across the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we will look at the results we know and the results we don't yet have from Tuesday's election, how Utah is remembering North Ogden Mayor Brent Taylor, and the conservation deal in the works, minus one big player in the for the Central Wasatch Mountains. Joining me for this conversation is Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
We've got government and politics editor Dan Harry as well. And
good morning,
welcome,
Roger.
Dan. Well, good morning to you. Public lands reporter Brian Maffley. Hi, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks.
Listeners, you are invited to join this conversation with your questions or comments. Call 801-355-8255 to do that, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com. Tuesday's election, you know, went off without a hitch in most places of Utah. Dan Harry, let's get up to speed on the 4th district race. This is a race where we don't know who won, and it's hard to tell when we're going to know who won as well.
Two words, Utah County. That is why, that's the main reason we don't know right now. And it got to the point, you know, I've been complaining about the Utah County clerk office for years on your program and elsewhere.
I know.
And yesterday, the governor and lieutenant governor, who's the state elections officer, both took shots at the county clerk's office because there were long lines. They have released very few votes, the count of very few votes, and they haven't released any vote counts since Tuesday night, whereas the Salt Lake County clerk's office has been daily updating those tallies. It's kind of a mess down there.
There was advice from the lieutenant governor's office to not release any additional vote tallies after election night until
Friday,
which is today.
Yeah.
But why not the initial vote tally? Why did so little come out of Utah County? I mean, you said long lines. What is the reason given for why we haven't seen very much from?
Well,
Utah?
They gave a lot of reasons. They gave the reasons that they didn't have enough machines, that they weren't prepared for people who were registering that day, and who were voting in person to read the long ballots. They didn't realize. They said that there was so much on the ballots. How could you not know that? I mean, they're putting out sample ballots and. It's just it's remarkable. Anyway, so bottom line is it's a very close race. Latest count as of yesterday, Ben McAdams is up about 3.5 points. Robert Gerke, the Salt Lake Tribune columnist, did a very informative column today. He said it's dangerous as having a pet Wolverine with a journalist doing math. But I think he did a really good job. And his calculation is that if the votes come in at the rate they have been, Ben McAdams wins.
Right.
If, as the Love campaign says, Democrats vote early and those votes get counted early and Republicans trail in later, then Love still has a shot at it.
Well, I mean, that's a big if, and the fact that Utah County is a Mia Love stronghold in this district.
Yeah, it's about 3-1 in Utah County in favor of Mia Love.
I want to just go back to the voting. I mean, was the fact that Utah County has by-mail voting, I mean, almost every county in the state of Utah does, are fewer people taking advantage of by-mail voting in Utah County than they are in other counties? I don't know if you can
Well,
that,
I know that Utah County was one of the later counties to adopt by-mail voting. So they did their first try at by-mail voting last year in the special election to replace Jason Chaffetz. And they had some screw-ups then. But generally, you know, you expect there's some problems the first time around, but they kind of iron those out. They didn't iron those out. And so this is the result.
I want to ask Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce about this. Jennifer, the governor, I can't remember the exact language that he used. It was pretty strong language pointing to Utah County as being a problem spot in elections. I mean, what's your take? What's going on in Utah County that's preventing us from seeing He said that they were, it was the epicenter of dysfunction. That
yes.
That was the term that he used.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of remarkable that he's calling them out. He was a Utah County Commissioner for years and years. So these are his people. They're his neighbors. And to sort of pinpoint that as the epicenter of dysfunction, kind of highlighting ineptitude, I think it's a really sharp rebuke, and they better get their act together. Because, again, if this happened in another 2 years or even in municipal elections next year, there will be hell to pay.
Yeah. Dan, just quickly, there was a hullabaloo made about voting in Salt Lake County on the eve of the election about problems that may be occurring in Salt Lake County. Did anything come of that? Were there issues like there were in Utah County?
There were some folks who got their ballots close to the deadline. But most of those by in time to mail them and to get them in, receive their ballots. The main flap that you heard was over a lawsuit, and it was filed by Sherry Swenson's Republican opponent, Roseanne Mitchell, and Dan McKay, a Republican legislator. And so they filed a lawsuit saying that, Sherry Swenson hadn't gotten on top of this, that a lot of people were missing ballots. They were hearing anecdotally that a lot of people hadn't received ballots. And they had no evidence. So it looked very much like an election eve stunt. And a judge did hear it on Monday and promptly threw it out,
saying that the voters weren't being disenfranchised by this.
You said there was no evidence of that. Yeah.
Just going back to the fourth district race and how tight it is, maybe we can address that for a second with Jennifer Napier Pierce here. Robert Gerke, as Dan pointed out, extrapolated those numbers, said if things hold, it looks like we're going to see a Ben McAdams win. This is a really competitive seat, comparatively anyway, but since, Jim Matheson left that district, the Democrats have not been able to take it. Why is it seemingly more competitive this year than it has been in past years?
Well, I guess there are a few factors. One, Democrats are emerging in stronger numbers here in the state of Utah. I think the demographics of the state are changing a little bit. I think that the fourth district, the way that it's drawn, will always be one of those districts where there's not going to be a clear winner. It has gone back and forth. If we do the
way that it's drawn now,
the way that it's drawn now, and there was an initiative to create this independent redistricting commission. It is just teetering. I don't know if it's going to get over the line. I'm sure we're going to talk about that. But the way that the 4th District is comprised, it's going to be a battleground seat for a long time to come if it remains this way.
How about the moment in history that we are living, or, is the fact that Ben McAdams is the name that he is versus, Doug Owens, who ran a couple of years back.
Mm-hmm.
Is that playing into this too? I mean, we don't know what the results are, but
Ben McAdams has made a name for himself first in the Senate. He's worked in Salt Lake City. 85% of that district is in Salt Lake County, which he has represented and is well liked. I don't think it's any surprise that he's done very, very well here. The wild card, as you mentioned, Dan, is Utah County. And Mia Love does very well in the rural areas of the state and in Utah County, where I think there's still 89,000 ballots to count.
Right.
89,000. So to say that Ben McAdams is ahead by 7,000, we really don't know what the final gap is going to be.
Dan, do we know how many ballots are outstanding in Salt Lake County?
It's about the same number, about 90,000. Mm-hmm. They started out with a lot more,
right,
because 85% of that district is in Salt Lake County. Mm-hmm. So they've been steadily whittling that down, whereas the Utah County number has stayed the same, the uncounted ballots, since election night.
Now, we're getting some numbers today, aren't we?
Yeah, we should be getting numbers this afternoon.
I don't want to dwell on the 4th District forever, but the president weighed in on this contest as well in sort of typical Trump fashion. Dan Harry, he took a swipe at Representative Love. What did he say?
It was part of that. If you watch that wild news conference the day after the election, where the president was calling out by name House members who lost, and he included Mia Love in that number, although, we don't know if she lost that election, but he kind of mocked her. and said that, you know, she was one of those who didn't embrace him, and that's why she lost. Well, as it turns out, we just found out yesterday, she actually did ask for help, and the president recorded robocalls, but it was a very limited use because the Love people know that the Trump is very unpopular in the 4th District, one of the areas where he is most unpopular in the state. And so they identified those who are considered strong Trump supporters, just a few thousand, and they targeted those robocalls to them.
In any case, premature to have said, you know, you lost and you should have utilized me more, since we don't know what's going on in this race. We're kind of on hold in this race. As you said, further vote tallies are expected today, and we will know more soon.
Yeah.
I don't want to go through every race because I think most people know the results of Tuesday's election by now. A spoiler, if you don't, Mitt Romney won. But Dan, any other big races between candidates that are still too close to call? We'll get into initiatives in just a moment. But
we saw a really interesting race in San Juan County. And, you know, that's been in the news a lot lately. They had a court-ordered redistricting that was attempting to correct what the court said were generations-long inequities that had disenfranchised Navajos in San Juan County. And so the court ordered this special election. They redrew the boundaries because San Juan County refused to do so. So the court did it itself. And what we saw was three county commission seats, two of them now contain majority Navajo voters. And so the one race, the Navajo Democrat clearly won election night. The other one is the Democrat was leading, but that one is too close to call as well.
And this is the seat with Willie Gray Eyes, mm-hmm. who was kicked off the ballot for a short period of time. Yeah. Brian Maffley, you've covered that part of this story, the fact that he was knocked off the ballot and then brought back on.
Yeah, there were some people in the county who filed a complaint that alleged that Willie Gray Eyes, who's a prominent Bears Ears Monument advocate, was not a San Juan County resident. Even though, he's been involved in elections and politics in San Juan County for a very long time. Apparently, Mr. Gray Eyes spends some of his time across the border in Arizona, and it led to some confusion about where he actually lives. Like a lot of Navajo in San Juan County, especially in his chapter house, they have P.O. boxes in Tonalea, Arizona. So the county clerk had concluded, maybe prematurely, that Gray Eyes wasn't qualified to be on the ballot, and that decision was challenged in court. And Willie Gray Eyes prevailed.
And stayed on the ballot and appears to be winning. He's got a 160-vote lead or something like that at this moment with ballots to count. What will that mean for San Juan County, the fact that it goes from being, you know, one Navajo on the three-person council, correct?
Yeah.
To a majority, two and one.
Yes, it'll be quite interesting because very conservative Republicans have controlled that county for since the beginning of the county's history. And now you'll have two Navajo on that county commission comprising a majority. We're not sure. The school board may be in a similar situation as well. And the fact that they have districts, it's the only county commission system in Utah that does have districts, and that itself was ordered by the courts maybe in the 80s. And so what it'll mean is you'll have two Navajo running the county, and the two Navajo, assuming Willie Gray Eyes wins, are, you know, two of the most prominent national monument advocates, and so assuming you've got this majority, what would that now mean for the county? Will become the county leadership now will become pro monument, whereas for years it's been from the beginning has been virulently anti monument. And so these two, Kenneth Maryboy and Willie Gray Eyes, they'll not only want the monument restored to the 1.3 million acres that President Obama designated, but what was the tribes that originally proposed, which was far larger.
You know, there were election observers sent down to San Juan County to make certain that the vote carried out the way that it should. And this is the first election since that court-ordered redistricting, essentially a voting rights case. Right?
Yeah, and this is basically a special election. All three county commissioners had to face re-election, and one of them, Phil Lyman, chose not to run.
And ran for state legislature and got a seat.
And he handily won that election, yeah.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, editor of the Tribune, changes in San Juan County, you know, part of that the result of the courts having to step in. Well, you know, Brian's kind of given us the overview of what it means. What do you think what is your take on what's happening in San Juan County?
I'm not sure what's going to happen. We do have a new representative, Phil Lyman, who's replacing another arch conservative, Mike Noel, in the state legislature representing this area. And then you contrast that with two Democrats out of a three-member commission. I think it'll be really curious to see how the leadership plays this, because I would say, in at least my observation in a lot of rural areas of Utah, local officials have this outsized influence because they're just so few, but they have an equal voice in the state legislature. So we have this super conservative voice coming from San Juan County to the state house, and then you've got more of a moderate to progressive angle at the very local level. It's kind of a schizophrenic arrangement, I don't know how it's going to turn out.
Continuity in one level and an overhaul, a sort of change at the other level.
Yeah.
I want to move on to a couple of more election items before we take a break and then turn to some reporting that you did, Brian Maffley. And so, Dan, I'm going to just jump away from candidates here for a moment and into the realm of propositions. Medicaid expansion, medical marijuana, both of those passed. Independent redistricting commission, that appears to be passing.
I don't know about that.
It's teetering, right?
It's got about a 1%
percentage
point lead right now, about 10,000 votes.
Fact check here.
All these counts out there to be counted. It's been failing in rural counties and in Utah County and conservative counties. So
we don't know.
So there's more votes to be counted in Utah and rural counties than there are in Salt Lake County. So that one could be in trouble. And it's quite surprising because there was no organized opposition to it. And the polls showed that it was popular.
Mm. You know, whether or not, and just looking at all three of those initiatives for a moment, whether or not that one passes, if they do all pass, are all of them doomed to be, you know, undone or cannibalized by the state legislature? We know one is, anyway, the medical marijuana initiative.
Yeah. And, you know, that's been up front that both sides, the organizers of the initiative, got together with the legislature and said, you know, maybe we can come up with a compromise. They've got a bill. They're going to go into special session December the 3rd. They say they think they will pass that. So, I mean, that's not one where the organizers of the initiative are going to cry foul. Some of the folks who are very strong advocates that were not part of the negotiations will. But for the most part, they're going to say, yeah, this is a deal that we can live with. It's practical. You know, it's going to be the most efficient way to actually get medical marijuana to patients that need it. The others are in a very different situation, and we're going to be watching this very carefully going forward. Does the legislature feel that they can just override the views of the public and tinker or in some cases reject these propositions that were passed on the statewide ballot?
It's a great question. And, you know, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, ostensibly a citizen initiative, is the will of the people, the direct will of the people. What do you make of the idea of the legislature sort of cutting the people out of, you know, making rules around things like medical marijuana and maybe Medicaid expansion or other initiatives? What's your take?
Well, we've had overt, you know, a shot across the bow from Senator Jake Ondrej.
Yeah.
He says, this is a budget buster and we're going to change it. I think I would proceed with extreme caution if I were in the state legislature to just unilaterally ignore the will of the people. I do not think that's going to play well either at the ballot box or in public public sentiment, if they choose to ignore these ballot initiatives and the, you know, the legitimate results that come out of them, I think there will be protests on Capitol Hill, and rightly so. I mean, I think, you know, there's a reason why citizens decided to circumvent the legislative process. It's because of their inability to act on certain issues year after year after year. And so I think that they should tread very lightly if they're going to ignore what comes out of these votes.
Lawmakers like Senator Andrick say, you know, this isn't exactly the will of the people. You had to have a big bunch of money put into an initiative and to even get it on the ballot, to gather the signatures, et cetera. And so it's not, you know, the people's voice. Although I suppose you could say the same thing about lawmaking in general.
Sure.
I don't know. How do you respond to that argument,
though? Well, I think, yes, of course, the world that we live in has big money behind anything that's going to get in front of voters. But I don't think there's any denying they put up such a hard process for these initiatives even to get onto the ballot. You cannot ignore the thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people who came forward and said, I support at least the chance to vote on this. And if they pass it, you know, these legislators are going to face some real scrutiny.
I want to move away from this and actually away from politics and government in just a moment.
But it's so fun.
I know, it's so much fun. But and head to a break. But just before we go there, President Trump asked for the Attorney General, this is Jeff Sessions, to resign this week, making a lot of people worry about what might happen with the Mueller investigation into Trump's campaign, into his dealings, Russian interference in the election, conceivably. There were protests last night, as a matter of fact, over this here in Salt Lake City and around the country. Senator-elect Mitt Romney has weighed in on the firing of Jeff Sessions, on the need to protect the Mueller investigation also. Dan Harry, what did Mitt Romney have to say about all this?
So, yeah, he tweeted out that the Mueller investigation needs to go forward unimpeded. And so it was quite interesting because Romney, who, you know, once was a leader of the Never Trump movement back in 2016, has been much more quiet about Trump lately. But there are occasions when he speaks out. And it was interesting that right after the election, he speaks out. So, you know, maybe that's a preview of the way that he'll conduct himself in the Senate. It was also interesting to note not a peep from the senators Mike Lee or Orrin Hatch about this. They said Jeff Sessions did a great job, but nothing about the Mueller investigation. Not a word.
And I think Representative Curtis also spoke out in favor of continuing the Mueller investigation. I think they're hearing from their constituents that it's not okay for Trump to dismiss that investigation.
All right, we will leave it there. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will turn to the conservation deal that is apparently in the works for the Central Wasatch Mountains. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
When I was a kid, I loved the little house books.
There was nothing but woods. There were no houses. There were no people.
I do remember talking to my grandmother who grew up on a farm. Her reaction was that, no, it was much worse than that.
Writing truth, writing lies. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Some of the most innovative music from Celtic roots is built around the rock of acoustic and electric bass. Hear players like Ricardo Del Fra and Alain Gentil on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Tonight at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and public lands reporter Brian Maffley. This is our Friday morning news wrap-up, and you can call us with your questions and comments. We are at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Brian Maffley, we will leave the elections behind and turn to some reporting that you did this week on a conservation deal in the works for the Central Wasatch Mountains. This is the canyons to the east of Salt Lake City. This is a deal with a legislative component that has been in the works for some time. It may now be on the cusp of coming together once and for all. Is that right, Brian?
Yeah, next week, the Central Wasatch Commission ought to be finalizing proposed legislation that would be then hand it off to either Mia Love or Ben McAdams, whoever wins, or possibly John Curtis, to carry forward in Congress. So the Wasatch, or Central Wasatch Commission, is an outgrowth of the Mountain Accord process that's been under, you know, in the works for several years, trying to address the problems of, you know, development and traffic congestion in those canyons just outside of town that are home to, you know, four major ski areas and the backyard for, you know, outdoor recreation. It is it's amazing amenity for us to have, and yet they're under amazing pressure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To grow, to expand, to develop. What are the components of this deal? There are land swaps involved. What does that mean?
Pieces to this conservation proposal, none of which directly address traffic congestion. But what it is supposed to do is kind of lock the four ski areas. Now one of them dropped out, so three of the ski areas' footprints, lock them in place. No more expansion outside of that. The ski area that bowed out is Alta, which has one of the most famous reputations in the ski industry. It's also recognized as a leader in, you know, in environmental stewardship. However, their desire to develop land they own in Grizzly Gulch has really gotten sideways with the environmental community. And because of their unwillingness to let go of Grizzly Gulch, they have been carved out of the proposed legislation, which will create something called the Central Wasatch National Conservation and Recreation Area. Quite a mouthful. So I'm just going to call it a conservation area for short.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And so what it does, it's about an 80,000 acre area, and it will expand some of the existing wilderness in this area by about 8,000 acres, cut some out along the foothills mountain bikes can ride the Bonneville Shoreline Trail, which is, you know, basically, you know, right up against subdivisions. So it's not like a big loss to wilderness.
Sure.
And it also creates some kind of special management area in the White Pine drainage immediately down canyon from Snowbird, which would, it's basically wilderness, but it has exemptions to allow motorized access. So there's a reservoir up there at Red Pine, allow the reservoir owners to take care of it, and, you know, heli skiing as well.
What about small landowners, you know, people who have wanted to develop luxury homes or whatever up the canyons?
These folks really feel chiseled in the whole process. They're the ones who are leading the charge against it. They claim that they've been cut out of the process. The process with a lot of cozying up with the ski industry. They felt like it was in a kind of a hidden way, kind of rigged to benefit the ski areas. And so what's a big piece of the conservation plan would allow the ski areas to exchange land they have up on the mountaintops, which is not really developable, for land, for Forest Service land near their base areas. And so the idea would be to allow them to own their base areas and facilitate further development, you know, with condominiums and restaurants and that sort of thing.
Causing more traffic for the canyons.
Exactly. And it's like, well, now you're talking about inviting more people into the canyons. And so a lot of these property owners, many of them, you know, live around Cardiff Fork and Silver Fork and Big Cottonwood Canyon, really feel like, you know, gosh, we would like to develop our property because of water and development restrictions imposed by Salt Lake City. They can't really do much with their land, and yet they don't have an option for trading or selling their land. They feel like, why do the ski areas get this special deal? That's their big beef. But, you know, the Central Wasatch Commission, which is overseen by former Mayor Ralph Becker.
Yeah.
Tried to appease those folks, tried to bring them along to no avail. They kind of recognize there's no way to make everybody happy.
I want to bring Jennifer Napier-Pierce in on this for just a moment. Jennifer, this is, a Central Wasatch project with a final deal in the works for legislation that, Brian, I want to come back to you on that in a second, but to manage the Central Wasatch, it's kind of a long time coming. What do you think of the fact that they're maybe on the cusp?
I think it's progress, but the elephant in the room remains traffic. You know, how do you get people in and out of the canyons and preserve the beautiful, pristine wilderness that we have up there? I mean, it's a balancing act. I don't think that the negotiations are over, and they sort of left the tough one for last. So I don't know. I don't know in the long term how ALTA opting out is going to affect the long-term planning of this. So that's another kind of question mark that remains for me.
Well, they saw, I guess, obviously a benefit to staying out, and that's the potential to develop this Grizzly Gulch land that they...
Exactly. But then there was a benefit of staying in that they would be able to exchange that land for a lot of... or some land, not at their base.
Why couldn't they be brought on board, Brian? They stuck to their guns.
Well, they were adamant that they needed to hang on to Grizzly Gulch in the event that they needed to accommodate even more skiers, and Grizzly Gulch would have been a great place to run a lift to accommodate those skiers. Now, the backcountry user groups are dead set against this. They feel that the ski area boundaries are big enough as they are, and we need to save some of the more of the backcountry for kind of dispersed use. However, it is private land. It's old mining claims that they do own, that ALTA owns.
Right. Yeah. Just on the legislative part of this, does it matter that we have a split Congress now, a Democratic House, a Republican Senate? Do you see any roadblocks to this getting passed?
Front, yeah. Not really. I think there'll be a strong bipartisan component of it. Jason Chaffetz introduced it 2 years ago, and it didn't get much headway. And then, of course, Chaffetz left office, so leaving it all in limbo. And Mia Love inherited the shepherding this legislation,
and she may keep it or she may not. We'll see.
Yeah, we're not really sure. No. It seems clear that John Curtis would be happy to take it. It's his district. He's the congressman who replaced Chaffetz. Maybe it belongs with him, but we don't really know. Things are so in limbo now with the McAdams Love race being undecided at this point.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll be covering this, and as it makes its way into legislative form and into a bill. I want to turn to another story that you reported on this week, Brian. It was a hearing that you covered. A hearing having to do with the Green River. There's this proposal, not unlike a number of proposals around the West, to reroute some of the water from the Green River to elsewhere. Explain what this project is.
Not the Lake Powell pipeline, but very similar. There are some entrepreneurs in Colorado who would like to divert 55,000 acre feet of water from the Green River in Utah to, you know, out of the Colorado Basin to the Front Range of Colorado, where Denver and those growing cities are. So this is a proposal that's been around for a long time. It's been shot down a couple times in the past and resurfaced earlier this year when the key figure in this, Aaron Million, filed for a water right for the 55,000 acre feet with the Utah State Engineer. What necessitated that was his point of diversion. His proposed point of diversion now is no longer in Wyoming like it was in the before, but in Utah, just downstream from Flaming Gorge Dam. So it creates this kind of awkward situation where the Utah state engineer is overseeing a water right being sought by Colorado developers that do not have the state of Colorado stamp of approval. So it's like really unclear, like why should Utah be the one overseeing this? There's so many critics of this proposal, and they came to the hearing
You talked about some unlikely bedfellows for this. I mean, in yeah. other places, like, you know, if you look at the Lake yeah. Powell pipeline or whatever, you have
They would be on these critics would be on opposite sides of the table if it was the Lake Powell pipeline, which is a Utah project. However, on this project, they're on the same they're at the same table. These are the environmental groups, rural Utah counties, the state of Utah, all came to this hearing basically protesting this water rights application, all making similar arguments. You're going to dewater the Green River. This is water that would otherwise flow to Lake Powell, which is dangerously depleted right now. And you have several species of endangered fish in these stretches of the Green that where the state of Utah is kind of obligated to maintain minimum flows to protect those fish. So a lot of these rural counties' water conservancy districts are worried that if this pipeline is built, it'll be a multi-billion-dollar reason to keep the water flowing to Colorado, even though it's a junior right to them. And they feel that their water rights will be impaired.
Would this diversion be for new development of the Front Range or for existing water use or what?
Yeah, that's the problem with this proposal. Aaron Million has not identified who will use this water. He's very vague in general, and clearly there is demand for the water. However, he can't say it'll be City X or City B or some a particular agricultural district. And that's one of the criteria. There's many criteria he has to demonstrate to get the state engineer's approval for this water right. One of which is, do you have the financial ability to pull this off? Is it feasible to build this 375-mile underground pipeline? A lot of things. And the critics of the project say, no, he hasn't demonstrated any of them. The Utah Attorney General was there, kind of ticked off the criteria that the proponents have not met. And the main thing is you need to demonstrate an end user here, and you haven't done that.
If we look at the Bear River diversion or the Lake Powell pipeline, they have that end user demonstrated?
Exactly. Yeah. That's what the big difference here is. Aaron Million likes to say that his project is no different than the proposed Lake Powell pipeline. However, there are some key differences. The Lake Powell pipeline is sponsored by the state of Utah. The end user is, Washington County. We know where the money would come from, although it's still not clear who's going to pay for it. There's a lot of knowns there. With what's called the Flaming Gorge pipeline, it's much longer, 375 miles, involves a lot of hydro power along the way. Aaron Million says it'll cost about $1.1 billion. There were some federal lawyers there saying, no, it'll be more like $8 to $10 billion. And so you've got a lot of unknowns here, and it's also a private developer proposing it as well. That's another big difference.
Who makes the final decision here? Has a decision been made on?
Well, the state is arguing that the state of Utah is arguing the state of Colorado should make a decision about whether this project is worth pursuing, and then come to the state of Utah to ask for the water right. So right now they're in the this is. After 10 years of proposing this thing, they're really kind of at square one asking for the water right. So the state of Utah says, you've got the cart before the horse here. You need to, get your thing sorted out with the state of Colorado first, then come to us to ask for the water right.
Who is it who said whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting?
I think that was Mark Twain, but I'm not sure.
Sounds about right.
We'll have to double check that. Jen, are you heartened by at least the idea that these sometime adversaries, you've got, as Brian pointed out, environmentalists, state lawyers, federal attorneys, joining forces, at least in this one instance. What do you want to comment on this, I guess?
Well, I think it's always good when people come together, even if it's just a well, it's not a turf war, it's a water war. But, you know, I think at least sometimes these strange bedfellow situations can get people talking and you can find a little bit of common ground, so to say.
Yeah. Is this likely to happen, Brian? I mean, given that sort of united opposition, I mean, not that you want to speculate, but...
I'm not going to speculate, okay. but I'll tell you, I think it's highly unlikely that this pipeline would ever get built, given the pressures on the Colorado River system.
Okay. You know what? It's time for another break in the show. There's still more to come here on Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio and KCPW. You are listening to Behind the Headlines. We'll be back in just a minute.
Have you seen that new Netflix show, The Haunting of Hill House? It is terrifying. Like, it's the first time I've said to the producers on the show, I don't want to watch this. But I did. And one of the stars of that terrifying show, Elizabeth Reaser, will be by to talk about how it's scary, but also about family. That's coming up on Q from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
It was a big week in American politics with remarkable repercussions for the future of democracy, so of course everybody spent their time trying to figure out the best water metaphor for it. It's not a blue wave, but a blue ripple. Maybe a blue wave, but not a big one you can surf, but big enough to knock over a sandcastle made of the president's tax returns. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the show that presents news coverage that's supposed to be ridiculous. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Tomorrow morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Dan Harry, and Brian Maffley. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, the Tribune reported extensively this week on the death of North Ogden Mayor Brent Taylor, a major in the Utah National Guard who was killed in Afghanistan this past weekend. Killed in an insider attack by someone he was training. This happened on Saturday. Brent Taylor has been remembered in vigils and in words. Tell us about who he was and what's being said about him, Jennifer Napier-Pierce.
You know, he was admired as both a soldier and a statesman. I believe this is his fourth tour, two tours in Afghanistan. And then on the civic side of the blotter, he was a mayor. He served as a member of the UTA board. He was a questioner. He was very analytical. I think his closest associates admired him because he was fair-minded. And it's just such a tragedy at age 39. I think people saw a tremendous political potential with this young man. He leaves behind a dedicated wife and seven children. We had our Washington Bureau Chief Tommy Burr at Dover Air Force Base when his body finally returned to the United States. And I mean, very, very emotional homecoming. But his wife's words were, there are no regrets. I mean, she was 100% supportive of his ultimate sacrifice. And it sounded like very much a family effort. You know, they believed in service to country, and he really embodied that.
Yeah, she had some very eloquent words. Yeah, Dan Harry.
Can I just say a couple of things about Brent Taylor, too? Yeah. One of them was his last social media post was urging people to go out and vote. And, you know, that's been spread throughout the country on social media, and it's quite a remarkable message. The other thing was, as during his time on the UTA board, Brent Taylor was the squeaky wheel. He was the only one that was dissenting from what was essentially this rubber stamp board, and he took a lot of flack for it. But I'll tell you, I think that his efforts went a long way towards the reform that we've seen in the last few months.
He had some serious criticism. He compared the board of his, you know, town of North Ogden and how much time they spent meeting over small questions and how little time at the time the Utah Transit Authority Board.
Exactly. And that was not well thought of by other board members who do not like public dissension. So it took some real guts to do that.
A reformer, and as you said, he leaves behind a wife and seven children. Jen, the United States has gone from having more than 100,000 troops in Afghanistan 6 or 7 years ago to a much lower number, 14,000. And there's a big topic we could open up there about U.S. intervention and the whys and was it worth it. But just focusing on that drawdown, I've seen analysis that says leaving a small number of forces opens soldiers up to a greater level of danger for people who are serving in Afghanistan.
I mean, I'm not a foreign policy expert, but I will say that Major Taylor had nothing but praise for the people in Afghanistan that he was working with. He absolutely thought that they supported democratic values. He was very complimentary of the way that they were training and moving forward as a country. So, I do think it's been a very long slog, but at least from his perspective, the United States has made a difference there. I would like to bring everybody home. That's just my personal opinion. But to have representatives like Brent Taylor out there, you know, trying to make a transition possible, I think is not a bad thing.
There's a lot of coverage of the life of Major Brent Taylor, who was the mayor of North Ogden and who was killed in Afghanistan on Saturday, in the pages of the Tribune. I want to, just before we wrap up the end of the show, circle back to where we started, which was the election on Tuesday. And one topic that we didn't tackle was the constitutional amendments. We talked about the propositions that passed and one that we're waiting to see whether or not it passed. It's teetering. But there were three constitutional amendments. All of those passed, Dan. Tell us what they were.
One of them didn't pass.
Oh, really?
It was a property tax deduction for property leased by the state. Very technical. Two of the three were technical. Yeah. The most interesting one, which all the polls indicated was going to go down to defeat, was allowing the Utah legislature to call itself into special session. Right now, the governor has that exclusive power and has had since the Constitution was written back in 1896. It's worked out pretty well, I think. But there was a fight last year over how to elect a replacement for Jason Chaffetz, and the legislature did not like the outcome. The governor would not call them into special session. He set the rules himself. And so that passed. And I'm not sure why.
They did this. So a two-thirds majority of the legislature can now call themselves into special session.
Mm-hmm. And I'm speculating here, but I think one of the reasons maybe people voted for that, you know, they probably didn't know a lot about it going in. And when they read the language on the ballot, it says the legislature can do this for emergency purposes. But guess what? The legislature gets to define what an emergency is. So their view of what an emergency is versus the normal person's may be very different. This does tip the balance of power between the executive and legislative branches.
I was going to say it is adding a lot of additional power to the legislature over the governor. Jennifer Napier Pierce, tit for tat, but Robert Gerke, a columnist with your paper, wrote that he kind of viewed this as a worthwhile thing to vote for because of the fact that it was a balance of power issue, and that maybe the governor has outsized power, or that this isn't expanding the power too much. But it does seem like a pretty sizable addition of powers of the legislature.
They already have the power of the purse. On this one, I will just say that Gerke is wrong. I think he was absolutely wrong. I'm sorry that people read him and listened to him, because I think that this can be a process where it's just going to be a mess. When they determine, whatever the issue of the day is, an emergency, and they call themselves into session, I think that's dangerous. I really do. And I do think that the governor should have retained that power. And he's been pretty judicious with it. I mean, I don't think that he has called special sessions on, willy-nilly, whatever. We'll have to see if the legislature takes that power and uses it.
Just one last thing, too. This will never be undone.
No,
because
no.
A constitutional amendment has to be initiated by the legislature. They are never going to give up power.
This is the way it is. And, I think Utah benefits from having a part-time legislature. And so now any unfinished business is just going to be it could be a pathway to a full-time legislature, and that's a real shame.
And a question that I asked, I mean, just before we head to our underplayed stories of Gerke, was what happens if you have, you know, in some future, an executive branch that is of one party and a legislature that is a majority of another party? And, I mean, does this give the legislature the power to kind of skirt around, you know, any sort of proposed rules that an executive from a Democratic executive might have?
Potentially. You know, I don't see that happening in the near future, but it's possible, yeah.
We will leave this here and keep covering it, obviously, and see what happens. But we need to turn to our final segment of the show, our underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight some stories that maybe didn't get enough coverage. Dan Harry, do you have one ready?
I have one ready.
Okay.
So the governor's Office of Economic Development on Tuesday, Election Day, approved up to $75 million in tax incentives for a convention center downtown. Huge.
Hotel, right?
Hotel, yeah. Excuse me, at the convention center. And this thing is going to be like 750 rooms. It's going to have a 25,000 square foot ballroom. And they've been, you know, kind of debating and massaging this thing for 10 years. Why do you make that vote on Election Day knowing that it's going to get buried in the news? Hmm. You know, it kind of surprises me that they did that.
Are you really asking that question? Or is Brian Maffley, do you have a pick for underplayed story?
Oh, yeah. This I hate to, you know, invoke Robert Gerke again, but he he mentioned something very interesting in one of his columns about a couple Garfield County sheriff deputies showed up with a dog at the restaurant that Blake Spaulding Hell's Backbone in Boulder, to question her employees whether they're rightfully registered to vote in Garfield County, which, of course, is one of the counties in the Grand Staircase. And Blake Spaulding, the famous restaurateur, was profiled in The New Yorker about a month ago. Is famously kind of a contrarian in Garfield County. And Blake was extremely upset about it and tweeted all about this intrusion onto her restaurant.
A suggestion of voter intimidation maybe in that story, and you can check that out at sltrip.com. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, your pick for underplayed story.
Gosh, I'm torn. There's a really interesting story this morning about a University of Utah neurobiologist who has just been appointed to the National Science Board and does not think that the Trump administration has talked enough about science. So we'll see if she can make an impact. My second is just a tidbit on Phil Lyman. Was cleared of he's been cleared for probation. He was convicted of a misdemeanor. He was fined $90,000. Guess how much he has to pay every month in order to pay that debt off? $100
a month.
It's going to take him 75 years. So thank you, U.S. Attorney, for allowing that kind of a settlement.
Wow. Okay. Some interesting and breaking underplayed stories from Jennifer Napier-Pierce. I'm going to go with Armistice Day. Sunday marks 100 years since the First World War came to an end. We now observe it as Veterans Day. Whoa. Sorry about that. There's some great photos that the Tribune has in a feature on their website of the front page of the Tribune just after the World War I ended. Check it out.
I saw that archived. It's really crackly. It is really cool.
And it was really big.
It's too. Really big.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Dan Harry, Brian Maffley, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. We'll see you back next week.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.
Utah Public Radio would like to thank our partner, the USU Office of Global Engagement, for sponsoring the UPR original series, Crossing Borders. Find out how you can become a sponsor of a UPR original series by calling 435-797-3138. Happy 65th anniversary, UPR.